VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya delays the planned reopening of its border with Somalia due to Al-Shabaab attacks.
A lot of the problem is of Al-Shabaab also is within Kenya, and I think Kenya needs to realize that everything that's happening in the form of terrorism in Kenya is not coming from Somalia.
South Sudan's president promises to hold elections in 2024. A female vice presidential candidate in Liberia's October elections says she's far more qualified than most of her other competitors. Medical workers in Sudan's capital risk their lives to save others amid intense fighting.
The most important issue here is the medical supply. We cannot get any supply from anywhere. We have got promises as well from the Minister of Health, but it's not as much as we want, you know.
And the daughter of former Zambian President Edgar Lungu complains of sensationalizing corruption allegations against the family. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Somali political analyst says the time has come for a comprehensive approach to combating the Al-Shabaab terrorist group, other than relying on strictly military solution. Faisal Abdi Roble says the group has been operating in the region for over 20 years, and that despite a military campaign by the African Union, Al-Shabaab continues to wreak havoc. This comes as Kenya on Wednesday decided to delay the planned reopening of its border with Somalia due to sustained Al-Shabaab attacks inside Kenya. Analyst Roble tells me Kenya is making a gut reaction to the Al-Shabaab problem.
Well, I think it's just the Kenyan government doing a gut reaction to some of the challenges that it has faced with the terrorist group of Al-Shabaab. And it is, you know, making some political decisions to probably appeal or show some of its constituents to what it would like to do.
Therefore, it seems a realization that perhaps the government knows that Al-Shabaab is causing problem in Kenya.
Well, it has always been causing a problem in Kenya, and some of the problems are from without Kenya, but a lot of the problems of Al-Shabaab also is within Kenya, and I think Kenya needs to realize that everything that's happening in the form of terrorism in Kenya is not coming from Somalia.
A colleague of mine spoke with a member of the Kenyan parliament yesterday, and the member of parliament indicated that he thinks that the attacks in Kenya are increasing because of the pressure that the Somali government is putting on them inside Somalia. What do you think?
Actually, that could be one theory, James, and I will not undermine that theory. But the other theory could also be that Al-Shabaab, with a small force in the region, feeds off of media attention, and this is one of the ways that Al-Shabaab really makes into the map of the world by being covered by the world media when they do small things. So I think it could also be this Al-Shabaab's new way of ensuring to the rest of the world that they still exist. So whenever there is some challenge from somewhere, they have to throw stones at other places such as Ethiopia and Kenya, where they have cells, and nobody can deny that. So I think, yes, pressure could be one, but at the same time, this could be Al-Shabaab's method to publicize its work and its existence at this point.
That is a big challenge for the region, then.
It is a big challenge for the region, and Al-Shabaab is almost 20-plus years old, and they have existed, and they seem to continue to exist. So I think what has been lacking so far is a comprehensive approach to Al-Shabaab other than the raw military approach, which has not been successful for over 20 years. So I think it's about time to go back to the drawing board and say, how can we address the issue of Al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa? Now it's impacting directly. It's impacting Somalia, Kenya, and Ethiopia. And fighting against them has been going on for a while, but they're still there. So I think something beyond the military approach needs to be done.
But you know already there is a regional force in Somalia.
Yes, there is the African Union, and then there was a recent agreement between frontline states, including Somalia, Kenya, and Ethiopia, and I think Djibouti, to directly assist Somalia and create a pact against Al-Shabaab. So Al-Shabaab could even be reacting to that pact that they created, but that is still within a subset of the AU forces that have been in Somalia for the longest period of time. And Al-Shabaab is weakened, but still it exists. So I don't know why Kenya is now wishing that nothing would happen.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, James.
Fiza Abdi Roble is a Somali analyst. He was speaking with us from Los Angeles, California. Medical workers in Sudan's capital are risking their lives to save others as intense fighting between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, continues in Omdurman. Dr. Rashid Mukhtar is volunteering at Adnan Hospital in Omdurman and other primary health centers in the area. He tells viewers Nabil Biajo that hospitals are losing patients with gunshot injuries because of an acute shortage of blood.
We're facing some problems in the medical supplies. The hospital is running 24 hours emergency room. We have an ICU, dialysis, and theater. We've got also 2 days for cancer patients for chemotherapy. The most important issue here is the medical supply. We cannot get any supply from anywhere. We've got promises as well from the Ministry of Health, but it's not as much as we want, you know.
Yes, in the current context of the ongoing fighting and conflict in Sudan, what are the most frequent medical needs as far as patients coming to your hospital and no hospital and other hospitals that might be open around you? What are the emergency cases, the pressing cases that you deal with?
All the injury between the civilians, either by weapons or by the Air Force's attacks. The most important item here is the blood needs. Most of the patients, they need a blood transfusion, and we don't have even, you know, the kits for blood transfusion. I mean, like the bags and the wires and et cetera. And we cannot get them from anywhere. I'm just using my relationships with some other colleagues in Al Saudi sometimes, some hospital around, you know, some private companies, but it's not enough. Most of the patients are dying because we can't give them any blood, to be honest. The dialysis patients as well, most of the dialysis centers has been closed or out of service. And no hospital is like one of two of centers in Omdurman itself. But every now and then, the dialysis kits are deficient and we have stopped doing the dialysis and we lost too many patients, you know, because we don't have dialysis kits. On the other hand, in the ER, we've got too many issues with, you know, the gauze and plates and everything that we can do to, like, to suture the patients, to the anesthesia medications, everything. We don't have anything right now, to be honest with you. The situation is catastrophic. In the theater itself, our only one consultant, the surgeon, was he stopped working as he wants. He wants some money, you know.
How long can you keep doing this without getting significant supplies and support from organizations and without the fighting, you know, calming down?
It's a very difficult question, to be honest. You know, we're doing our best, keep stand and keep giving the service to the patients. But believe me, if I can send you a video of today's situation, it's very bad, you know. We lost like five civilians fighting around the facility of the hospital. It's around. And the problem is most of the patients, they cannot get into the hospital itself because the fighting, they cannot stop fighting to let them go, you know.
As I understand, the current fighting in Omdurman, the area where you are, it's mostly about controlling supply routes for the RSF and the army.
Yes, exactly. You're right.
That was Dr. Rashid Mukhtar, a general physician currently volunteering at Sudan primary health centers around Omdurman. He spoke with VOS Nabil Biajo. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has vowed to hold elections at the end of the country's transition in 2024. He says he will work with the signatories of the 2018 peace agreement to ensure that elections take place on time. William Sunday Mambo reports.
Of SPLM-IG supporters at the stadium in Western Barlagazal State, Capital Wau, chanted slogan Tuesday praising President Salva Kiir during a rally to endorse President Salva Kiir as the party's presidential candidate in the next year elections. Addressing thousands of party supporters, President Kiir says there will be no more extension of the transitional period beyond 2024. Kiir welcomed his endorsement as his party's presidential candidate for the next year's elections.
I am deeply touched by your endorsement to be the SPLM flag bearer in 2024. Your continued support for our historic party gives me confidence that we will stand together as we go towards elections next year.
President Kiir says the country's governance system will change after the general elections. He says the current mandate of the transitional government of national unity ends in 2024, as stipulated in the country's roadmap.
As the party, let us work on the basis that there will be no extension of this transitional period when it ends in 2024.
President Salva Kiir said his conflict with the armed opposition drains the national resources for developing the country. He says he put an end to fighting across the country to give room for development in South Sudan.
War takes away resources from service delivery. These were interrupted by the senseless war which we fought from 2013 to 2018. Its intensity, it stops implementation of government plans, and it is for these reasons that I signed the Vitalized Peace Agreement in 2018.
The president says his government will use the available resources to improve the living conditions of the South Sudanese.
We have initiated national projects. We have road construction going on in different parts of the country, including a highway that is coming here to Barlagazal. It has already come to Terkeka, and it will come all the way to Wau here.
He appealed the signatories of the 2018 peace agreement to put aside the conflict-related plans and focus on the service delivery to South Sudanese. First Vice President Riek Machar did not attend the event for endorsing President Salva Kiir as the flag bearer of the Sudan People's Liberation Party in 2024 scheduled elections. For VOA News, I am William Sande Mabur in Wau.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Buckley in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 6th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The vice presidential candidate of the collaborating political parties, the CPP of Liberia, has been defending her decision to accept the job, even though some say one of the group's members, the Liberty Party, is involved in a leadership struggle. The CPP is made up of the Alternative National Congress, ANC, led by Alexander Comis, and the Liberty Party, founded by the late Charles Bramskin. Bramskin's daughter and a lawyer, Charlene, is now the vice presidential candidate for the CPP in Liberia's October election. She says she accepted the vice presidency because she followed the rule of law as decided by Liberia's Supreme Court. Councillor Bramskin is in the United States, where she and her running mate just concluded their party's convention last week in Philadelphia. First, I asked her about the other criticism of her, that she is too young and inexperienced.
If you look at the presidential tickets right now, I certainly feel that, particularly with those who are vying for the vice presidential slots, my experience surpasses most of their experiences. I have been fortunate as one of the few women in Liberia to lead a very reputable law firm to engage in legislative drafting, at least to assist the government of Liberia in both administrations in providing my legal advice to drafting legislation, to drafting policies and regulation. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm an employer. I am an assistant professor of law. So I think my experience far surpasses any other vice presidential candidate on the 2023 ballot. So I think that those who are the naysayers or the opposition to the CPP ticket will try to identify what they will call like low-hanging attack fruit, right? A ways to attack me. And that's the only thing they come up with, that I have inexperience. But when you actually compare, you know, on paper, my experience far surpasses their candidates.
One of the things that I hear people say, and I have observed covering elections in other countries, is that it's difficult for the challenger to defeat the incumbent. Many people question that the opposition in Liberia is so divided. How do you defeat an incumbent when you are divided?
So, yes, we have heard, you know, folks say the opposition is divided, it's splintered, and so there's no way that we can defeat the incumbent. So, first of all, I want to disabuse people of that notion, because there is strength in the opposition. And when there is an incumbent who has not performed, the Liberian people will decide who they are going to pick. And if that person is not going to be the incumbent, then I believe they will rally around the opposition candidate that they feel is best suited to change the direction of this country. If the opposition isn't going to rally around one candidate in the first round, I certainly think that there will be a united opposition in the second round. There might be. So I don't think we need to be so concerned about a splintered opposition. I think Liberians need to be more concerned about how we finally decide as a people that we want better, that we can do better, that we deserve better. And we start, you know, looking at these small mechanisms of politics and say, look, we must come together and we must identify the candidate that can finally get us back on track with the rest of the region, the continent, and the globe.
Your father, the late Charles Walker Bramskin, founded the Liberty Party, of which you are a member. But the party has been embroiled in leadership struggle. And some say that by accepting to be vice presidential candidate for Mr. Cummings, you have taken side rather than help to unify the party.
Thank you so much for this question, because it's something very personal to me. Liberty Party certainly has been embroiled in a leadership crisis. It's a crisis. And when my father was alive, because of his style of leadership, you never heard Liberty Party involved in any of these, you know, antics that we see in other political parties in Liberia. So I want Liberians to know that I have certainly taken a side. And I have taken the side of the institution, and I have taken the side of the rule of law. I have respected the Supreme Court's ruling, wherein the Supreme Court of Liberia was very clear that the administrative functions of the Liberty Party, as well as any other political party, vest in the chairman of the party and the executive committee. So the chairman of the party, whether any Liberian likes it or not, at this point in time, is Musa Bilete, and I took a side. I certainly was not going to be embroiled, continue to allow our party to be torn apart by a few who were very determined to support the Unity Party candidate. There is no way that I, as Charlene Bramskin, a member of Liberty Party, a counselor at law in Liberia, and the daughter of the founding father of LP, would give up my absolute obligation to support Liberty Party so that I could support the Unity Party candidate. I was never going to do that.
Charlene Bramskin is the vice presidential candidate for the Collaborating Political Parties, the CPP of Liberia. She spoke with me in Washington, D.C. In Zambia, the family of former President Edgar Lungu says the government is behind media allegations of corruption against the family. The government arrested the former president's son and daughter-in-law on allegations of money laundering used to purchase property worth more than $5 million. Police spokesperson Ray Hamuga told VOA in June the two owned 69 motor vehicles and other properties believed to have been bought through illegal activities. Tasila Longu is a member of parliament and daughter of the former president. She tells me the family feels the tabloids are using the case to go after their father.
We've been accused of several different issues, different family members, myself, my sister, my brother, my mother. We only found out about those accusations through the media. So we woke up the next morning, we basically heard that we're being charged of these various charges. Then that our lawyers now had to try and go and find out through the courts to see if anything had been filed.
So what do you make of the allegations?
Well, like I said, I can't really discuss those issues in particular because they're in court at this time. So I can't really go into those specific details, but I could send you what the articles said, what those articles were about those allegations.
I see that the allegations are that I think your brother and daughter-in-law charges of money laundering and possession of property believed to be proceeds of crimes worth more than $5 million. That's what I'm reading in the paper.
Okay, yeah, so probably it would have been something like that. But like I'm saying, I can't really go outside of what the article discussed. So, because, you know, those matters are now with the lawyers. The lawyers are handling that. So I'm not really in position to get into details about those specifics. We've been tried through the media, basically. That's what the complaint was yesterday.
You say that the law enforcement is dramatizing your circumstances. How?
How are they dramatizing it? Because when a person is accused, the first thing that you do is to take them to a court of law, and then they answer through the courts of law. That is what we mean by dramatization.
What do you make? Because let me say, reading the papers from Zambia, or the opinion in some papers, it seems to me that the public seems to think that you deserve, or that something went wrong.
Okay, James. So thank you so much once again for that question. Like I've constantly said, I can't really get into the opinions and what people think. That's really not a situation that I need to get into at this moment. So that's what I was saying to you, and said that I needed to stick specifically to that article and can't really provide any other information apart from that. And sorry about that. But when the right time comes, if you're still available, we can still have another chat. I think it'll be better maybe if we can speak once the matters have been concluded, like I said.
So when do you think the case is going to go to court?
It's already in court.
Has there been any kind of charge or charges brought?
At this point, like I mentioned in my piece of communication yesterday, for even the lawyers to find out what those charges are, at this point, it's not clear because we hadn't been served those papers. But our lawyers are still making efforts to find out the specifics on those charges, what those charges are. They're trying to get a hold of the paperwork to find out what the charges are.
Tasila, I do appreciate very much speaking with you. Please feel free to contact me again once there's new development in the case.
Thank you for taking the time.
Tasila Longu is a member of parliament and the daughter of former Zambian President Edgar Lungu. She was speaking with us from Lusaka. And that's it for this Thursday, July 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington, saying have a great day, and please be safe whatever you do.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Next up, a conversation about U.S. national security priorities and strategy with former Assistant Secretary of Defense Mary Beth Long, the first woman to serve in this civilian four-star military equivalent in the history of the Pentagon. We discuss the major challenges facing the United States and NATO as they confront a rising China and a revanchist Russia. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Obstetric fistula is one of the most serious and dangerous injuries pregnant women go through during childbirth. According to the World Health Organization, more than 2 million young women go untreated in Asia and Africa. This week on Our Voices, we'll explore the cause of fistula, discuss prevention, as well as reintegration of women back into their communities. Join the conversations Wednesday at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports.